government and responsibilities. And this is probably the primary text that you will find in the New Testament, if not the Bible, that deals with this subject. Last week, we pointed out some things that are important to know on this subject, and we'd like to finish the development of it tonight. And that is that the governing authorities derive their power from God. We saw how that anyone in a position of power over a nation, however, must answer to God for the decisions that are made. God can remove a king anytime he desires. And in the Bible, we saw that with Jeroboam. Jeroboam did not die a natural death. Neither did Ahab. God removed him and everyone related to him from power. We saw the same thing with Belshazzar, who was thinking, like Nebuchadnezzar had, that everything belonged to him and he could do what he wanted. And in fact, even used the as drinking vessels, holy vessels that had come from the temple of the Lord. But God removed him from power. And he can remove anyone from power if he so desires. But tonight, we want to see what the government's responsibility is to its citizens, as well as what our responsibility is to government. So let's talk about the function of government first. Ideally, we want wise leaders. And when we have a chance, we ought to select the very best that we can. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 13. I know this may seem like an odd place to find an applicable principle, but let's read it. In Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 13, choose wise understanding and knowledgeable men from among your tribes, and I will make them heads over you. Now, God gave his people the opportunity to choose in this particular case those who would lead over them. Of course, God was ruler over all and over the nation of Israel. And Moses was his spokesman. But they had a chance to select some men to rule over them, and they were to choose wise, understanding, and knowledgeable men in order to do that. That's precisely what we need to do when we have that opportunity, and we do in this country. As we mentioned last week, we have the responsibility, the obligation, and the privilege of voting for people, to every 2 to 4 years. We have what are called midterm elections as well as regular elections, and we ought to be concerned that we select knowledgeable and wise and understanding men when we have that opportunity. Now, that means maybe taking some time to figure out what those men believe. How are you going to know if they're wise or understanding? How are you going to know that if you don't do any work? I'm persuaded there are too many people that have been elected based on charm or good looks or something else equally superficial, and people had no idea what they believed in and found out and regretted it later. So we have the opportunity to do what they did in Deuteronomy, and we really need to take advantage of it. I decided years ago I would not vote for anyone who was pro-abortion. And to my knowledge, I never have, and I don't ever intend to. I am also not going to ever vote for somebody who is pro-homosexuality or pro-homosexual marriage. Not going to do it. Now, in all honesty, I got to admit, I can't get a candidate that's wise enough to agree with me in everything. But there are some things that just cannot go. There are some things that just cannot let slide. And so I make it a point to find out what those people do believe and what they're going to support and what they're not. And I think everybody ought to do the same thing before casting a ballot. Now, one thing that leaders must not do is to lead people into sin. Jeroboam did that. Now, granted, God appointed Jeroboam, and he gave him the kingdom because he tore it away from Solomon by means of Rehoboam. He tore it away from Rehoboam. But the people did not choose him. They did not ask him what his platform was, and they did not know that he would set up two golden calves. On the other hand, when it happened, who opposed him? How many people in the northern tribes said, "We cannot allow this. This is a direct violation of the Ten Commandments"? Where was the protest against that action? Well, we don't read of any. Thus, we read a couple of hundred years later, well, more like 350, in 2 Kings 17:21, that God took Israel captive because of the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. God gave them time to fix it. They didn't fix it. It is still the case that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Proverbs 14, verse 34. So what leaders do affect their relationship with God, the people's relationship with God, and how God may deal with that country or that nation. So we want people who do not and will not lead the population into sin. Now, I grant you, you can't always know that. But there have been some cases when we could, and we elected such a person anyway. Number two, they have, to borrow a phrase you're familiar with, the government has the obligation to promote the general welfare. That is the good of the nation. Let's go back to Romans chapter 13 and verse 4. He is God's minister to you for good, but if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister to execute wrath to him who practices evil. He wants good to be brought about in the nation, but he punishes evil. And so this is a two-edged sword, so to speak. We have our interests, the people's interests, the nation's interests, should be at the heart of a leader's thoughts. Number three, likewise, it is their job to take care of crime and punishment. And that would not only include the leaders of a nation or a state or a community, that would also include judges who are put in positions of power. Letting a child molester off when he had been perpetrating the crime on someone for a five-year period with 2 years probation is just absurd. And anybody who would do that needs to be recalled or gotten rid of through any legal means possible. The state sometimes can do something about it. Sometimes citizens can do something about it. But that's not protecting people. And if we have people in office and in power who will not promote the general welfare, protect the general public, and cause evildoers to pay for their crimes, then something is wrong. Those people ought not to be in power, ever. Justice must be fair, but serious crimes demand serious punishment. Our system of law, including the courts, should protect the people. That is one of their God-given functions. Number four, they need to maintain internal peace. Again, this may seem like an odd place to go for a principle, but let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 30. 1 Samuel chapter 30, verses 21 through 24. Now David came to the 200 men who had been so weary they could not follow David, whom they also had made to stay at the brook Besor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. Then the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said, "Because they did not go with us, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart." Now, you know, these men were too weary to go, 200. The rest of them went, put their lives at risk, and they fought. And so their thinking was, well, we did all the work. Why should they partake in the plunder that we got? But notice how wise David was in his answer. "My brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies. They shall share alike." David resolved this matter. And it was important that he do that in order to maintain internal peace. There are always going to be problems of a nature such as this. But there is a solution. And David set forth that solution, and everybody abided by it. Number five, the purpose of government is to protect the rights of its citizens. Let's go to Acts chapter 22. Acts chapter 22, beginning with verse 25. Paul had been making a defense concerning his apostleship, and the crowd took offense to what he had to say, especially when he mentioned the word Gentiles. So, as they bound him with thongs, and the commander just assumed that Paul was at fault, since all this turmoil had broken out. And as they bound him with thongs, verse 25, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?" Paul knew the answer to that question. When the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, "Take care of what you do. This man is a Roman." Then the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he said, "Yes." The commander answered, with a large sum I obtained this citizenship. And Paul said, but I was born a citizen. Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him. And the commander was afraid after he found out he was a Roman and because he had bound him. You see, you could not do that with a Roman citizen. You might do that with a foreigner. You surely could do that with a slave, but not with a Roman citizen. They were afforded certain rights. And Paul had the right to be protected by the law. And thus he appealed to that. Of course, also, citizens have the right to be protected from foreigners who intend harm. Let's go to the Old Testament again for an illustration from 1 Kings chapter 20. 1 Kings chapter 20, beginning with verse 1. Now Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered all his forces together, 32 kings who were with him, horses and chariots, and he went up and besieged Samaria and made war against it. Then he sent messengers to the king, to the city, to Ahab, the king of Israel, and said to him, thus says Ben-Hadad, your silver and your gold are mine. Your loveliest wives and children are mine. And the king of Israel answered and said, my lord, O king, just as you say, I and all that I have are yours. Problem solved? Well, not quite. Let's keep reading. Then the messengers came back and said, thus speaks Ben-Hadad, saying, indeed I have sent to you, saying, you shall deliver me your silver and your gold and your wives and your children. But I will send my servants to you tomorrow about this time, and they shall search your house and the houses of your servants, and it shall be that whatever is pleasant in your eyes, they will put it in their hands and take it. So the king of Israel called the elders of the land and said, notice, please, and see how this man seeks trouble. For he sent to me for my wives, my children, my silver, and my gold, and I did not deny him. And the elders and the people said to him, do not listen or be content to do that. Don't follow him. Don't do what he says. Now, what do we learn from this? First of all, appeasement doesn't work. First demand, Ahab said, okay, it was not a reasonable demand. But Ahab agreed to it. What happens? Next day, I want more. And as Ahab took that to the men, to the elders, they knew that that would not be the last either. There would be something further that followed. Once you agree to one demand, there's no stopping point. He might feel like stopping and might not pursue it, but there's no stopping point. Appeasement does not work. Citizens need protection. And that is the function of government, one of the functions. Now, the same thing could be applied to illegals. They are a threat. And they cannot be granted rights. You know, it would seem like a matter of logic that an illegal would not have the rights of a citizen. And yet we hear such crazy things in that regard. If they're not legal, they don't have rights. They are here illegally, and they are breaking the law. Now, that's not to say something might not need to be done, that there couldn't be some solution suggested, but they don't have rights. Non-citizens don't have rights. If they are afforded legal status, it is an insult to all of those who have obeyed the law and come here and spend about 5 years of their life working toward citizenship. And also, what value is there in being born a citizen if you can come to a nation illegally and be made a citizen anyway? There's no advantage whatsoever. And so the government needs to protect its citizens in all of these ways. But now, what about the responsibilities of citizens to the government? Number one, primarily, citizens have a responsibility to obey and comply with government. Otherwise, we are resisting God. Notice again, Romans chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And the government, the authorities that exist are appointed by God. And so if you, if you resist the authority, then you resist the ordinance of God. So that's why we say we have that responsibility to comply with the government. Let's look at another passage from 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13. Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or to governors, or to those who are sent by him for punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of those who do good. So there can't be any question as to what our responsibility toward government is. Also, we are commanded to pray for those who are in authority. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 1 through 2. And that includes all of this compliance with government, includes paying taxes. You know, I know some people are never going to like that. They're just not. They have all kinds of ways around that. Well, we're charged too much. Well, that's possible, but that doesn't change the command. It's an illegal tax. Well, that might be true, but it's irrelevant as far as our responsibility goes. People are fond of pointing out when Social Security was passed, it was never supposed to be more than 1%. Well, you see how that worked out. Well, that's true, but that's irrelevant also. Sometimes people say, well, I don't like the way tax money is spent. Well, who does? But that's irrelevant. Some don't want it spent on national defense, which is, hopefully there are not many people like that, but there are some. Others don't want it to be spent on welfare. Well, if you don't like the way government money is spent, that's why we have elections, to determine who is going to be in charge of the money. And that's another thing to find out, what kind of a budget are you going to have if you're elected? What's your emphasis going to be? Is there going to be a strong military that will protect all of us, or is it going to be downsized? What is your philosophy concerning that? So, regardless of whether somebody we like or don't like, whose policies we agree with or don't agree with, whether it involves taxes that we think are excessive, none of that really matters, except in this country we have the right to do something about that by electing someone else. But we still must comply, even though we don't like certain things and disagree with it. How many Christians do you suppose favored what the Roman Empire was doing with Christians by putting them into the Colosseum? How many do you think were in favor and could applaud Nero for putting them as torches, setting them on fire and lighting up the Appian Way in the evening. I don't think you'd get any Christians to vote for that. But that didn't mean they could rebel against the Roman Empire. They still had to comply. Even when laws were unjust, even if the emperor was unjust, God will remove him when he's ready to remove such a wicked person as Nero was. Now, having said all of that, though, there is, as I'm sure you know, one exception. When the government requires us to do what we cannot in all good conscience do. And you know several examples of this. In Exodus chapter 1, Pharaoh commanded some midwives to kill Hebrew male children. They refused to do it. They would not have any part in it because it was against the will of God. And they don't have the rights. They're not in the place of God. They're his servants, and they're supposed to be working on behalf of all, but when they do something that outrageous, that can't be complied with. We find the same thing in Daniel 3, 16 through 18, with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The command was, you will bow down, and you will worship the image. And they said, we will not. And you can put us in a fiery furnace. We don't know if God will save us or not. But whether he saves us or not, we are not going to do that which violates our conscience and our law. We're not going to do that. And so they did not, and God did preserve them. You have another illustration with Daniel. He didn't decide, well, okay, the king signed a petition. I guess I can't pray anymore for 30 days. No, he went right ahead and did what he had customarily done. And his enemies got him thrown into a den of lions. But that didn't work out too well for them. The lions didn't eat Daniel, but he ate them when they were put in his place. In the New Testament, we have a couple of passages, Acts chapter 4, verses 18 through 20. And this involves the preaching of the gospel after the church was first begun. Acts chapter 4, beginning with verse 18. So they called them and commanded them not to speak at all, nor teach in the name of Jesus. Now, can you imagine that? Well, yeah, probably you can. You've probably read it before. Can you imagine that that might happen to us one of these days? Well, it's not tremendously far-fetched. But they were commanded not to speak at all, nor teach in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John answered and said to them, whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you more than to God, you judge. For we cannot but speak the things that we have seen and heard. We can't be quiet about it. You might pass a law, and some countries have, where Christians are forbidden to meet, and so they go about and they meet in secret. But you don't have the right to take on God as your opponent. He is not going to favor you if you do that, and we cannot. We will obey everything else you tell us. We will pay exorbitant taxes. We will do things that we're really not in favor of because you are the one in authority, but we will not violate the will of God. Acts chapter 5. And verse 29, same situation, just a little bit later. But Peter and the other apostles said, we ought to obey God rather than men. Men are way overreaching when they try to be in the place of God. They don't have that authority. God did not give them that authority. And so that is the one exception. And by the way, Peter deals with what Christians had to face in several centuries to follow. Going back to 1 Peter chapter 4 this time, let's notice beginning with verse 14. 1 Peter chapter 4, beginning with verse 14. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part, he is blasphemed, but on your part, he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, or a thief, or an evildoer, or as a busybody in other people's matters. In other words, if you're reproached for Christ, that's fine and wonderful on your part, but don't deserve it. Don't do something evil for which it would be justified. Let it be unjustified that you are reproached for Christ. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter. Well, this is a brief look then at the responsibilities. I know there have been entire books written on the subject that can go into some of these things in much more detail. But this is a brief look at the responsibilities that government has towards its citizens and that the citizens have toward the government. May we abide by the teachings of the New Testament on this subject, just as we do in salvation and faithfulness. We must know how to become a child of God. And having become one, we must know how to remain faithful, which may in fact involve suffering, as we have just talked about. But to begin the road to heaven, one must repent of sins if you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. You must also confess that he is. Then you must be baptized into Christ for the forgiveness of your sins. And in order to verify that, just study the book of Acts. Acts 2, 36 through 38. Acts 8, 35 through 39, and Acts 16, 30 through 34, Acts 22, 16, and many other passages that go along with that particular subject. If you're ready to become a child of God and begin your pilgrimage toward heaven, we invite you to come. If you already have, but you've been distracted, put away those distractions. Come back to the guardian and shepherd of your soul, Jesus Christ. And if we can help you, let us know while we stand.